From the imposing heights of Prague's Castle District, tourists can observe the playful interplay between the city's Baroque and Gothic architecture. While the former is imposing, a product of Imperial Austrian occupation, the latter is majestic and somber, produced by Charles IV during Prague's time as the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. Below, one may follow the outline of the River Vltava as it flows by some of the city's best-known monuments, including the world-renowned Charles Bridge. The river's graceful, U-shaped curve glimmering from the sun's rays. As the tourists spread across the city, back and forth, up and down, they are taken by the beauty of the place, hardly peering beyond the exterior stone veneer. If only they would open themselves to it, then Prague's unsettling underbelly might reveal itself to them. As the capital of one of the small nations of Europe, Prague has had unimaginable horrors visit upon it, from the religious strife of the Hussite and Thirty Years' War up through the fascist and later communist repressions of the modern era. Prague is a city of heartbreak and tragedy. It is this uneasy relationship between beauty and horror that is captivating. Prague's most esteemed writer, the German-speaking Jew Franz Kafka, once commented on his own uneasy relationship with the city by stating that, "Prague never lets you go. This dear little mother has sharp claws." I have yet to find a better description of the city. Today, we delve into one of Prague's most fascinating stories, a tale of glory and infamy, where heroism, bloody reprisal, romance, and resistance intertwine. This would be 1942's Operation Anthropoid, the famed Anglo-Czech operation that stands as the only successful government-organized assassination of a top-ranking Nazi official. The target? Reinhard Heydrich, the brutal governor of occupied Bohemia and one of the architects of the Final Solution. The operation has grown in the imagination of the public over the years, and as such has spawned multiple film and media adaptations. This includes mainstream Hollywood productions such as 2016's Anthropoid, starring Cillian Murphy and Jamie Dornan, as well as 2017's The Man with the Iron Heart. For those who can stomach it, however, the 1964 Czechoslovak film Atanta, roughly translating to The Assassination, is much better. This historical podcast, / walking tour, / travel guide, seeks to trace the steps of the Czech paratroopers as they journey to assassinate Reinhard Heydrich and then move on to their time in hiding before they were betrayed, and detailing their final stand at St. Cyril Methodius Cathedral. From there, we will shift to an examination of the treatment of civilians in Prague as a result of this act of resistance and the acceleration of the Final Solution in the Czech Republic. Lastly, we will delve into the massacre at Lidice as a testament to the indignities inflicted upon the captive civilian population. This podcast will place an emphasis on specific locations where important events took place in their relationship to the city of Prague. While the daring exploits of the Czech paratroopers are well remembered in media, most tourists visiting Prague do not realize that the site of many of the events of Operation Anthropoid and its aftermath can still be visited and have taken a life of their own in recent years, many having been transformed into memorials and places of memory. This story contains a series of locations corresponding to different chapters. A list of these chapters and locations can be found in the description. If limited for time, stop 2, 3, 5, and 7 are optional parts of this walking tour. My name is Desmond, and I will be your host today. I run a small independent travel website called TubeSquareToBeHip.com, a narcissist guide to travel and culture. An interactive map of the locations pertaining to Operation Anthropoid can be found at this address. You'll find a link in the description. Enjoy the show. Chapter 1, Historical Context, Wenceslas Square. In 2022, I attended a Teaching English as a Foreign Language course in Prague. Walking to my classroom often took me by Wenceslas Square, where protests against the Russian invasion of Ukraine were taking place. The endless barrage of yellow and blue flags was dizzying and the energy from the crowd infectious. A long, dark shadow loomed over Europe once again, and I could not help to think of what it would have been like to be here in times past, where a different threat, that of 1930s fascism, stood on the horizon. Long, linear, and elegant, the squares always served as a stage for public demonstration. The most dramatic of these demonstrations were that of the Velvet Revolution, signaling the end of communist rule, the Czechoslovak hockey victory celebration over the Soviets in 1969, and the May Crisis in 1938, when Germans put pressure on the Czech authorities to hand over the Sudeten land. For those unfamiliar to Prague, the square is arguably the most important public space in the city. It is located on the east bank of the Vltava River in what is known as the New Town or Nové Mesto. At the head of the square, looking west, one will find a statue of St. Wenceslaus on horseback holding a lance. Behind him stands an imposing structure, the National Museum. The neo-Renaissance-style structure dates from 1891 and is one of the most striking in a city that does not lack in beautiful structures. My stay in Prague coincided with a special exhibit being hosted at the museum in commemoration of the 80th anniversary of Operation Anthropoid. Titled We Will Never Give Up, it proudly displayed documents on loan from the British National Archives pertaining to the planning and execution of the operation. The location of the exhibit in the confines of the National Museum in Wenceslaus Square was a fitting one. During the May Crisis of 1938, a large demonstration took place in the square below the museum. The Czech protesters were demonstrating against Germany's aggressive territorial demands and the Western Allies' policy of appeasement. The seeds of Operation Anthropoid lie in these years, as the Czech people will witness the subsequent dismantling of the Czechoslovak state and the occupation of the Czech lands, crushing the dream of former Czech President T.G. Masaryk, who had helped forge Czechoslovakia out of the ashes of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. On September 30th, 1938, the Munich Agreement was signed between the Western powers and Nazi Germany, again the Sudetenland, a border region with a large German minority, over to Nazi Germany. The Sudetenland happens to have a hilly landscape and was where most of the Czech defensive fortifications were located. Thus, the Munich Agreement left the Czechs defenseless. Worst of all, the agreement was conducted without the approval of the Czechs themselves. A formal invasion of Bohemia and Moravia would follow on the 15th of March 1939, proving to the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain that peace for our time with Germany was a fool's errand. The Czech lands were a prime target for Nazi Germany, who coveted them for their industrial base and munitions industry. What followed the invasion was a brutal occupation and repression of the Czech national identity and the Czech people. Germans did not view Jews and Slavs as racially equivalent and began to liquidate the ancient Czech Jewry. As a result of the invasion, the Czech national government was forced to relocate to Prague under the leadership of Prime Minister Edvard Beneš. Chapter 2, Planning an Operation, 1795, 7, Biskupchova Street, Zhizhkov District. So, who were the conspirators in the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, and how did they end up in Prague? The famed duo that took down Heydrich was a Czech-Slovak pair, that being Josef Gabčík, the Slovak, and Jan Kubiš, the Czech. Both had army experience and were in exile at the time of their recruitment. Of course, when you're a government in exile, you must pick from other exiles to build an army in exile. Both were good friends that fought in France, receiving the Croix de Guerre medal. Their tragic demise would make them both national heroes and martyrs. After France collapsed, they were evacuated to Great Britain. It is in Britain that Operation Anthropoid was planned. Edvard Beneš and the government exiled were worried about their status. In essence, they thought that there was a chance that the Western powers would not preserve the Czech national interest at the conclusion of the war. They also worried about the Czech government being viewed as a quisling due to the collaboration between Czech industry and the new ruling regime. They felt that they needed a dramatic act by the Czech resistance to command respect from the British. The stage was set. Operation Anthropoid was planned, executed, and its aftermath would reverberate throughout the country. The operation was organized by General František Moravec and the team led by both Gabčík and Kubiš, who replaced the injured sergeant Karel Svoboda. The team was picked from the best soldiers found in the army in exile, who were subsequently trained by the Special Operations Executive, SOE. On December 28, 1941, the two groups were flown over the Czech Republic, Silver A and Silver B. Both groups had different missions. The pair landed near Prague and met contacts in Pilsen. It is in Prague that they worked with the Czechoslovak resistance to plan the assassination. Documents related to the operation can be found in the British archives under Silver A and B Anthropoid. These are the same documents that were found in the National Museum during their exhibition. In Prague, their main safe house was the flat at 1795 Biskupčova Street in the Žižkov district, belonging to Mary Marivkova and her husband Alois Moravec. The flat still exists today. A patriot, her family actively helped plan the assassination, with one of her sons serving as a messenger for the parachutists and the other passing away in the service of the RAF. Her husband was not aware of their activities. Her story is a testament to the tragedy that befell most of the conspirators after the assassination. When the Gestapo came for her on June 17, 1942, she committed suicide before they could take her. Her son and husband were sent to the Mauthausen concentration camp, but not before they were interrogated and tortured. The son only gave in after being shown his mother's severed head in a fish tank and warned that his father would be next. As shocking as this story is, it is important for people to remember just how disgusting the Nazis were. There is nothing gentlemanly about these people. In the book, Assassination, Anthropoid, 1941-1942, published in 2002, several other safe houses are listed. These may be worth taking a look at if you have the time. They are 1837-4 Biskupec Street in the Žižkov District, belonging to Jan Jelenka Hejski. 1718-11 Kalinska Street in the Vinohrady District, belonging to the Fefek family. 15 Milantrivchova Street in the Old Town District, a home belonging to the Svatos family. 338-18 Veklevkova Street, belonging to Joseph Ugun. All these families were sent to the Mauthausen concentration camp except for the Ugun family, who all survived the war. The paratrooper's time in hiding also had an air of romance about it. While riding on the tram one day, Joseph Gabčík met his girlfriend Anna Malinova, who he later asked to find a girlfriend for his friend Kubiš. Her name was Mary Kovarnikova. The assassins both told their girlfriends of their mission, and their girlfriends became active members of the resistance, helping their lovers in the planning of the operation. It is stories like these that help humanize these men beyond being martyrs for their cause. If anything, they do not seem all that different from some of the young men I know. You can find pictures of the two friends together with smiles upon their faces during their time in England. This photograph is in sharp contrast to the stark militaristic look of men such as Heydrich. It is interesting that some of the most fanatical supporters of the Czech cause were women. Yet women were not given preferential treatment by the Nazi regime during wartime. Like Mary Morakova's family, the girlfriends and their families were sent to the Mauthausen concentration camp. In essence, with the help of the resistance, a plan was put in place and executed. The resistance deserves more recognition for their role in the operation. It is, after all, they who suffered for all their work. In the foreword to the book Assassination, Anthropoid, 1941-1942, Czech Minister of Defense Jaroslav Zvardek writes, "Personally, I would like to stress one of the most overlooked aspects relating to the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. The cooperation of the parachutists with representatives of the local resistance movement, who were ordinary Czech people, as well as members of the nation's defense and the Sokol organizations. In modern Czech history, we would find few examples of such close links between the armed forces and the civilian population. The one without the other would not have been able to carry out something of the kind." This being said, not all in Prague were thrilled with the mission tasked by the government in exile. Some worried about the repercussions to the civilian population. There is one controversial figure in this story who fits this mold, and that is Professor Ladislav Vanek, who ran an organization called Yindra and went by the same code name. He tried to talk the paratroopers out of their mission and appeared unhappy with the direction from the government in exile. After being arrested by the Gestapo on September 4, 1942, Vanek made a full confession that indicted many other members of the resistance. He was even willing to participate in a planned radio counter-campaign against the Czech government in exile. Many in the Czech lands consider him a coward and a traitor. Chapter 3. The Man with the Iron Heart. Beninske Bzhezhani. Our first stop outside of the immediate vicinity of the city of Prague takes us to Beninske Bzhezhani, a small, nondescript village with two impressive manor houses, Horní Zemek and Dolní Zemek, whose names roughly translate into upper and lower castle. While the word Zemek seems to indicate castle, it is actually the word for a large stately home more akin to a palace than a defensive structure, which would go by the name Hrad in Czech. To get to the village, you can drive or take the red line north and transfer to the 373 bus. Either way, it is a little over 20 kilometers from Prague. So, what brings us to this village? During the occupation of the Czech lands by Nazi Germany, their new name of the territory became the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. Of course, a protectorate needs a protector, and so Nazis installed one of their own as the Protector of Bohemia and Moravia. As you can imagine, the protector didn't do all that much protecting. The role was essentially that of a governor and functioned as a dictatorship. The first of these protectors was Konstantin van Neurath. Yet the Reich soon soured on him. In 1941, he was replaced by Reinhard Heydrich, as Hitler had considered him too lenient upon the Czechs and their well-organized resistance movement. Of course, a quote-unquote protector needs a home for himself and his family. Konstantin van Neurath made the lower castle his home, as did Reinhard Heydrich after him. The home itself once belonged to the Jewish sugar baron Ferdinand Bloch Bauer, who had fled the Czech Republic to Switzerland in 1939. The village offered protection from the Czech resistance that was particularly active in Prague itself. This meant that the protector would have to commute into the city for work. How mundane. During this time, Prague served as the administrative center for the occupiers. Prague Castle was made the seat of the state president, and the nearby Chernin Palace the seat of the Reich Protector. So, who was Reinhard Heydrich, our anti-hero that was referred to by Hitler as the man with the iron heart? The short answer? Heydrich was a Nazi's Nazi. Reprehensible, but grotesquely fascinating. When I look at his photographs, I was struck at how normal he looked. Tall, blonde, and athletic, with a militaristic look, he was as much a gentleman as one could expect from a naval officer. He fenced, rode horses, played violin, and was regarded as a man of culture. Don't let that facade fool you, however. He was very much the ruthless killer you imagine him to be. In the early years of Nazi rule over Germany, he founded the Nazi Security Service, charged with eliminating threats to the regime via arrest, murders, and deportations, and he helped organize Kristallnacht, the 1938 coordinated attack on Jews living in Germany. He was also instrumental in forming the Einsatzgruppen, a brutal SS death squad that were known for their mass murders in occupied territories via mass shootings. In 1941, he chaired the Wannsee Conference that would formalize the final solution to the Jewish question. Unfortunately for the Czechs, he was also not very fond of them. His callousness would soon earn him the titles Butcher of Prague and the Blonde Beast and the Hangman. He was not a modest human being by any means, once proudly proclaiming that I shall succeed the Führer. While conducting his anti-Czech activities, he rode around the city in an open-top Mercedes 320 Cabriolet B car. This did present an opportunity for ambush, as we will see later on. After the death of Reinhard Heydrich, his widow was gifted the property by the Führer himself. The old crow, whose name was Lena, followed in her husband's footsteps and ran a mini concentration camp for Jewish workers in the garden. Today, it is not possible to visit the lower castle. The rotting structure is privately held. As disappointing as this may be, you can peer through the iron gates flanked by stone lions to see the structure. However, the upper castle, Horní Zemek, is open as a museum hosting the Crime and Punishment exhibit detailing the occupation of the country by the Nazis and the consequences of it. The orange-painted neoclassical structure is in much better shape than the lower castle. It is here that Reinhard Heydrich's successor, Karl Hermann Frank, lived. A Czech-German, he was a prominent Nazi agitator and parliamentarian with the Sudeten-German Party. His cruelty against his fellow Czech citizens should not be underestimated. He was the organizer of the reprisal for Reinhard Heydrich's assassination, and he organized the Lidice and Lidzaki massacres. After the war, he surrendered to the Americans and would be hanged in Prague for his crimes. Chapter 4, The Assassination, Holisovice Curve. The Holisovice Curve is not a location that can be found on a map. The curve was essentially a major intersection with a sharp turn requiring a car to slow down when traversing it. It is, of course, easier to hit a slow-moving vehicle than a fast one. If one were to plan an assassination by way of a hail of gunfire or by the throwing of a grenade, this would be the place to do it. Before it was paved over, the curve was a well-known part of the roadway that took riders along a dramatic, almost 270-degree twist from a direction flowing southeast to southwest towards the Troia Palace. Basically, the road doubles back on itself much like a hairpin turn would. At the time of the assassination, this intersection was paved in cobblestone and was home to a tram line. It was relatively quiet, with traffic moving at a leisurely pace. Today, it is a major roadway interchange with no resemblance to its former self. In essence, it is busy, fast-moving, and jammed with traffic at rush hours. If you are looking for this location on the map, it is where Roadway 8 and the 608 collide, just north of the Bulkova Hospital. A monument to the assassination exists, tucked in the spaghetti of roadways. It is a steel tower with three men crowning it. A mural to the paratroopers has been painted on the north side of the interchange. May 27, 1942 was shaping up to be a beautiful day. The sky was clear, and our protagonists moved into place for their ambush. Across the street, they parked their bicycles and lied in wait. Another one of the paratroopers, Josef Valchik, from Group Silver A, was positioned about 100 meters up the road to look out for the approaching car. It was a day like any other, except Heydrich was late, which was unusual. Was he tipped off? As 9:30 a.m. turned into 10:30, the tension ratcheted up. Finally, the Mercedes came into view. So, what was the Deputy Protector of Bohemia and Moravia doing on the day of his assassination? He was performing the most mundane of tasks, commuting into Prague from his home in Panenské Břežany. As the car slowed down, Gabčík emerged, opening his raincoat to reveal a concealed Sten submachine gun. World War II buffs will know that the Sten was a cheap, poorly designed weapon prone to jamming. Ironically, there is a reason the Brits contracted out weapon designs such as the Bren gun to the Czechs. Of course, jamming was exactly what happened. Heydrich stood, drew his pistol, a Luger. His car came to a halt. Kubisch, who was not spotted, threw an anti-tank grenade. The explosive did not land in the car, but near the wheel well. The ensuing explosion shook the tram passing by, shattering its windows, throwing glass upon its passengers. Heydrich's car, for its part, survived the explosion, but shrapnel from the bomb and car caused major injuries to his diaphragm, spleen, and lung, as well as fracturing a rib. Kubisch, for his part, suffered facial wounds. Despite his obvious injuries, Heydrich and his driver, Johannes Klein, gave chase to the two men. Heydrich staggered towards Gabčík and Klein at Kubisch. Kubisch was able to hop on his bicycle and pedaled away, firing his pistol wildly back at Klein, while Gabčík, who had finally dropped his Sten, made for his bike. He was not able to make it and was forced to flee on foot, engaging in a short firefight with Heydrich, until the latter was no longer able to give chase. Heydrich ordered Klein in pursuit. Gabčík eventually tried to take refuge in a butcher shop, where he was outed by a Nazi sympathizer named Brauer, who attracted Klein's attention. Fortunately, Klein's gun was also jammed, and Gabčík was able to land two pistol shots into his leg as they collided in the doorway. He was eventually able to board a tram and reach a safe house. Both men thought the operation had failed, yet there was another twist to come. Upon the successful completion of the operation, C.M. Gubbins, the SOE Operations and Training Director, wrote to František Moravec, the Brigadier General from the Czech government in exile. He had this to say. I wish to convey the congratulations and admiration of myself and of my staff for the manner in which the members of Anthropoid have succeeded in carrying out their assignment. It is still too early to judge what the effects of this action are likely to be, but its importance is undoubted, especially as it regards underground resistance throughout Europe, and these two men, at least, have earned a place in Czechoslovak history. I hope that their splendid example will shortly be followed in other parts of the world, and the Germans themselves may learn what it is like to be victims of a reign of terror. In the meantime, our sympathy here goes out to both these two men whose positions must now be so desperate, and also to your fellow countrymen at home who will, I am afraid, be cruelly punished in the inevitable reprisals. Chapter 5, The Assassination, Part 2, Bolovka Hospital in Prague Castle. After his brush with death, a grievously injured Reinhard Heydrich was rushed to this hospital in Prague 8. He was in considerable pain, but still lucid. Luckily for him, the hospital was right next door, overlooking the curve. The Bolovka complex has a beautiful main hall, but these days most of its campus is modern and not worth visiting. It is here that Heydrich lost his life. After being rushed over, they began to remove the pieces of shrapnel from his chest and rushed him to surgery for his collapsed lung and other injuries. From here, Himmler himself sent down his personal physician, and he would be tended to by SS doctors. Himmler would come to visit him at his bedside. It seemed like he was recovering, but he would pass a few days later from sepsis caused by an infection. Heydrich's driver, Johannes Klein, was also transported to the hospital for surgery. He survived the war, but never walked properly again. After the incident, he recovered at the mansion of the new protector, Karl Hermann Frank, in Panenske Przyjaźni. Apart from a visit to the main hall, I do not recommend that you spend much time here. If you are still itching for something to do, ride a tram down to Hradčany to visit Prague Castle. After Heydrich's death, his body was moved to this location for the funeral. As a high-ranking Nazi official, he was given the highest honors, his procession passing through the castle grounds. The procession was lined by thousands of SS men with torches. A second funeral took place in Berlin for all high-ranking Nazi figures. In a video recording of the event, you can see a swastika-draped coffin being paraded through the district while a giant wreath is brought forth. During the funeral, a cortege of over 200,000 Czechs passed by and gave the Nazi salute to the coffin, hoping to avoid retribution. The act of groveling would not help them. The event is fascinating, but is a bit of a grotesque carnival, and as such, I shall not dwell on it. Chapter 6, The Manhunt, St. Cyril and Methodius Cathedral, National Memorial to the Heroes of Heydrich Terror. Days after the assassination, there were no signs of our heroes. The Nazis were furious. They were even more furious when nearly a month later, the assassins were still on the run. In that time, the administrative control of Bohemia and Moravia fell to Karl Hermann Frank. The massacres at Lidice and Lazaki had taken place under his orders, and more reprisals were promised if the assailants were not caught by June 18, 1942. This put pressure on the Czech population to betray their own. At first, Gabčík and Kubiš hid out with different families in Prague, but they eventually moved to the Cathedral of St. Cyril and Methodius with their fellow paratroopers under the protection of its bishop, who had taken it upon himself to hide them in the crypt of his church. They were eventually betrayed by a fellow member of the army in exile, the traitor Karel Kurda, who belonged to a fellow sabotage group. He also sold out several safe houses. This included that of the Moravec family, who had given the assassins shelter when they arrived in Prague, thus Kurda being directly responsible for their grim fate. For his help, he was given a large sum of money, a new identity, married a German woman, and spent the rest of the war as a Gestapo collaborator. After the war, he was tracked down and captured. At his trial, he was quoted as saying, "I think you would have done the same for 1,000,000 marks." He was unceremoniously hung for his crimes. Ironically, the Germans, who saw all Slavs as lesser people, thought even less of these sniveling collaborator types than their proud enemies in the resistance. They saw the latter as more likely to be Aryanized over the long run. They interpreted this defiance as a product of these Czechs having more German blood. The story of our protagonists concludes in the Cathedral of St. Cyril and Methodius, located on Rozlova Street in the new town, not far from the Karlovo-Niemiecki Metro. The building may seem unremarkable from the outside. The 18th century structure with its white stone walls serves as the main place of worship for the Prague's Czech and Slovak Orthodox population. It should be noted that Prague is primarily a Catholic city. It was formerly consecrated to St. Charles Borromeo, and you may still find that some books reference the building by that name. A simple-looking Baroque church in a city full of Baroque churches. Its narrow footprint has the structure tucked between the street and those buildings surrounding it. That makes it very easy to miss, as I did my first time walking by it. Today, the church is back in working order, but also serves as a place of commemoration marking the last stand of the heroic Czechoslovak paratroopers. Access to this memorial can be found via the crypt entrance that is on the podium below the entrance to the church. Accessing the memorial is free. Just be quiet and respectful while visiting. Remember, people have passed away here. Inside are busts of the 7 Czechoslovak paratroopers who lost their lives in the church. They are Josef Gabčík, Jan Kubiš, Jan Chubi, Adolf Opalka, Josef Bublik, Josef Valčík, and Jaroslav Zvark. It should be noted that this would not have been a pleasant place to hide out. In 1942, the crypt was dank, dark, and contained over 120 sarcophagi belonging to a series of priests and bishops. These days, the tombs are empty and the basement well lit. It is here that Jan Kubiš received medical treatment for an eye injury sustained during the assassination attempt. Getting a doctor to perform this work was no easy task, as medical professionals were required to report anyone with similar injuries to the authorities. The presence of several men in this small space kept the resistance busy supplying them. Lady Morovich and other members of the resistance were frequent visitors to the paratroopers. It is her that informed the assassins of their promotion from a broadcast received illegally from London. Another of their visitors was Professor Ladislav Vanek, who urged them to commit suicide in a public park to avoid further retributions. At dawn on June 18th, a blistering firefight would ensue when the Waffen-SS moved in on the church. At 4:15 in the morning, they formed a cordon around the building and moved in. They had hoped to capture the paratroopers alive, but that was not to pass. The first round of fighting took place in the main hall of the church itself, where Adolf Opalka, Josef Bublik, and Jan Kubiš were on guard that morning. The paratroopers surprised the interlopers with a hail of gunfire and forced them back. This went on for 2.5 hours, ending when the men were likely out of ammo. Kubiš was injured and unconscious from a grenade blast, and the other two had probably ended their own lives by suicide rather than be captured when their ammo ran out. When one enters the church today, everything appears in order, almost as if nothing had happened. Yet looking at photographs of the church in 1942, the interior appears devastated. While the fighting was happening upstairs, those hiding in the crypt kept noise to a minimum, hoping the Germans would not find them. Before the gunfight started, they had tried to break through the crypt wall to the sewers below, but failed. When the fighting stopped, they likely knew that it was only a matter of time. The Germans did not believe that they eliminated all the paratroopers. After all, where was Gabčík? He had not been identified by Korda as amongst the dead. The Germans eventually forced the priests to reveal the hiding spot of the rest. They moved a large stone over the altar and discovered the secret staircase leading down to the basement. Shots would soon ring out at the intruders. To help them try and lure them out, the Germans brought along Karel Korda and Ata Morovich, the captive son of the Morovich family. They tried to force Atta to plead with them to surrender, but he refused. Kirill Korda lacked the courage of this young man and was glad to do it. Yet the traitor's poisonous words did not have the intended effect. The paratroopers now knew who had betrayed them and shot back. Yesme, shishi, nikdi se nezdame slivste, nikdi, before opening fire. This would roughly translate to, "We are Czechs, we will never give up, you hear? Never." The remaining four paratroopers, Joseph Yabchik, Jan Hrubi, Josef Velchik, and Jaroslav Svark, made their last stand in the basement, where they were peppered with tear gas from a bullet-sprayed window at street level. The Germans even brought over a fire truck to flood the crypt. The window can easily be identified when walking around the church today. It still has the bullet holes, and now a commemorative plaque as well. By the time that Karl Hermann Frank arrived at the scene, he was furious. He pushed for the attack to speed up, but the basement seemed impregnable. It is in this dark crypt, a literal tomb, that the paratroopers made the difficult decision to end their own lives. They were nearly out of ammunition, and to be tortured by the Nazis would be a much grimmer fate. They had done all they could. After the battle, Bishop Gozrad took it upon himself to write a letter to the authorities. In it, he took the blame for housing the paratroopers to minimize the reprisals among his flock. The bishop of the church and his priests were liquidated, but not before the bishop was tortured. He was later made a martyr by the Eastern Orthodox Church. In the ensuing reprisals, thousands of civilians were imprisoned and killed for suspected partisan activity. This included Jews who were shipped by the thousands to camps such as Theresien. It also included friends and family of the paratroopers who were immediately eliminated. As for the paratroopers, their heads were separated from their bodies. Grimly enough, Gabchik and Kubis's heads were specifically preserved, placed in a glass cylinder, and locked away. The heads of the remaining five parachutists were taxidermied. On the 20th of April, 1945, the Gestapo took them away, and there's no record of what was done to them. To this day, the location of the remains is unknown, and the paratroopers have yet to have a proper burial. The operation and its aftermath were described in a quarterly report of SOE activities to the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Winston Churchill, in this manner. SOE agents have earned the gratitude of mankind by the removal of Heydrich. His executioners, two warrant officers of the Czech army, were dropped by parachute near Prague, and the act of justice was well organized and successfully carried out. They eluded capture for more than a month, but were, unhappily and eventually trapped, and in the ensuing fusillade, shot dead. The operations were organized at the request of, and in collaboration with, the Czech authorities here and in Czechoslovakia. The savage reprisals taken by the German protectors are deeply and to be deplored, but their effects have been to instill into the Czechs a still deeper hatred of their oppressors and to inspire them to renewed resistance. Churchill once stated that courage is rightly esteemed the first among human qualities because it has been said, it is the quality which guarantees all others. In the case of the paratroopers and their allies, it is clear that they displayed the finest qualities found in man himself. Chapter 7, A Brief Interlude, Paratrooper Pub. Our next stop on the tour is the Paratrooper Pub in Nové Město. Located across the street from St. Cyril and Methodius Cathedral, the pub would blend seamlessly into the building if not for the jarring green painted wall on the exterior of the ground floor. Unlike many of the tourist pubs in the Old Town, this is an old-school Czech pub. I personally prefer this type of establishment, cheap beer without the ghastly vapidity of tourist banter. For heaven's sake, try to fit in with the Czechs drinking here and do try some of their cuisine. Once you have a cold pint of pivo in hand, take the time to look around the restaurant. Up on the walls, you will find the portraits relating to the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. It is a good time to reflect on what you have learned so far and to prepare yourself for the natural conclusion of this story at Lidice. Chapter 8, Reprisals and Commemoration, Lidice. From the Nezdrazi Velitslavin metro station, you will find a 300 series bus with departures for the town of Lidice. The ride takes about half an hour through pretty but mundane farmland. It is hard to imagine that such a tranquil environment was host to one of the most savage war crimes of the Second World War. It is even harder to believe that it was wrought as retaliation for the assassination of a single man. You must make sure to hop off at the bus station in front of the memorial, else it'll be a 10-minute walk in from the town itself. Alternatively, there is a mostly empty parking lot near the memorial grounds for those who have opted to take their cars. There is little to see in the village itself, as it is in reality a new Lidice. It was recreated in a spot overlooking the old village destroyed by the Nazis from funds collected from the city of Stoke-on-Trent in the UK. Ironically, two brave Czechs who had served in the Royal Air Force during the war were not allowed to be housed in the new Lidice after the communists seized power in a 1948 coup d'etat. As for the memorial at Lidice, it can be roughly subdivided in three parts. The first is a large rotunda-like structure with two wings, one that serves as a cafe and the other a larger structure housing a museum. Facing south, overlooking a serene green valley, is a stone lookout. The second part is a rose garden with a fountain, also overlooking the valley. The third part is the most important. It is the green, verdant valley itself. It is in the valley that the village of Lidice once stood. Today, hardly anything is left of it. June 10, 1942, false Nazi intelligence linked the village to the Czech paratroopers, going as far as to suggest that it was a hiding place for the Heydrich assassins. As such, it was chosen as the target of a brutal act of retaliation. At first, the village was looted, burned to the ground, and dismantled. Then a watercourse that ran through it was rerouted. Roads leading to the town were torn up, and graves in the local cemetery were overturned. Finally, crops were grown over the remnants of Lidice, and a barbed wire fence erected, stopping anyone from entering. In essence, the village was erased from the landscape through thousands of hours of painstaking manual labor. The violence extended further than the built environment. Under orders from Karl Hermann Frank, the adult members of the town were shot on the spot and females sent to concentration camps such as Ravensbrück with their children. Very few survived. Unlike other Nazi crimes, the massacre at Lidice was proudly advertised. They were proud of their work and wanted the world to know what happened to those who stood in the way of Nazi tyranny. The same thing happened a few days later in the village of Lejaki. The former village site of Lidice now functions as a sort of outdoor museum with memorials, artwork, and informational panels linked by a pathway. One of the most striking pieces is the children's memorial created by the artist Marie Uchitilova. The haunting sculpture depicts the village children, 82 in total, which were gassed in 1942. The haunting memorial is known for its realism. There are 82 individual statues linked by a podium. The statues resemble the actual children but are given their own unique flares to differentiate them from the actual. She started the project in 1969, but funding took an eternity to come through, and by 1989 she passed away before it could be completed. Her husband sought to continue her work, and when funding was eventually granted by the Czech government, used her molds to complete it. You may also find the foundations of the barn where Lidice's men were shot, the foundations of the church, and the men's burial ground. From the Rose Garden, a panel shows you what this valley would have looked like before 1942, giving you an idea just how much was lost. Today, Lidice is a quiet place of reflection and commemoration. The site stands as a testament to the destruction wrought upon the little nations of Europe stuck between competing dominant powers. A testament to its importance can even be found internationally. Czechs in the United States installed their own memorial commemorating the event in Phillips, Wisconsin. And in the UK, the city of Stoke-on-Trent, the funders of the new village, completed their own memorial. It should be noted that the price borne by all Czechs for Operation Anthropoid. It is estimated that 5,000 people were murdered in the reprisals and more than 13,000 were arrested. One of these victims was Kubiš's girlfriend, Anna Malinova, who died in the Mauthausen concentration camp. Hitler's original aim was for 10,000 dead Czechs, but he was forced to back down by Himmler, who viewed the Czech lands as too important from an industrial lens and did not want to lose productivity. It should only be noted that the assassination also accelerated the liquidation of Jews and other undesirables during the Final Solution. A memorial to the Jews deported from Prague can be found in Holešovice. Prague is a rich Jewish history, and if you are interested, I recommend a trip to the Jewish ghetto, where many museums and cultural institutions are located. While few people attend the Memorial Lidice, I think it is well worth the trip. Conclusion. Before we wrap up, let's briefly return to Wenceslas Square during the Velvet Revolution. The year is 1989, nearly 51 years after the Munich Agreement and 48 years after the country was forced into the Soviet sphere of influence and into communism. Despite it being December 10th, in the middle of winter, a large crowd is gathered in the square to hear the playwright, dissenter, and future president of Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel, speak from the balcony. The excitement was palpable. Beside him stood a former president of Czechoslovakia, Alexander Dubček, now an elderly gentleman in his 60s. While Havel represented a younger generation of dissenters, Dubček had claimed the exact opposite. The Czech leader who pioneered the reformist slogan, "Socialism with a Human Face," represented an older generation of citizens whose hopes and dreams had been crushed during the Prague Spring. The demonstrations mirrored those in Bratislava that had kickstarted the movement. The Velvet Revolution was the end of one era and the start of another. No longer would Czech streets bear the names of their German or Russian occupiers, just as statues of T.G. Masaryk had been smashed and replaced with those of Hitler and Lenin. For Dubček, the man who had uttered the famous phrase, "You can crush the flowers, but you can't stop the spring," this moment was a prophecy fulfilled. So why are we back in Wenceslas Square, and why are we talking about the Velvet Revolution rather than Operation Anthropoid? I would ask myself the same question if I was in your shoes. After your journey through Prague, it is worth reflecting on the larger currents and themes covered by the tour. One of these is the price of resistance and its consequences. It is not difficult to imagine a direct lineage between the exploits of the Czechoslovak legions during the First World War to Operation Anthropoid in 1942 to the Prague Uprising of 1945. Through Prague Spring in 1968, and finally culminating in the Velvet Revolution of 1889. Freedom is paid for in blood, and the Czechs have already spilled more than their share. I hope that your time spent in Wenceslas Square can offer you the same appreciation of what the Czech people have accomplished and how much they have suffered. Epilogue. I want to leave you with one last thought. Historians have the benefit of being able to look back at the past with the foresight of their present times. a certain crop of scholars have come to question if the price paid by the Czechs because of Operation Anthropoid was too high. It would have been better not to have acted in this fashion. Not only is this question pointless, after all, most real historians don't dwell on hypotheticals, but it is also revealing of a modern value set that does not understand the antiquated values such as honor, valor, and an obstinate pride in the face of adversity. When one Czech generation had lost its will to fight the occupiers, the next took up arms until it too was exhausted in a repeating generational cycle. It is this very hard-headedness displayed by regular Czechs that earned them their freedoms. Not only did this operation lead to a recognition of the Czech government in exile as a political force and the struggle of the Czech people at large, but its memory gives hope to all those little people who long for freedom. I would like to leave you with this passage from the declaration of the Czechoslovak government issued in May 29, 1942. In the attack on the life of the monster Heydrich, the Czechoslovak people are punishing not only the crimes committed against the Czechoslovak victims, but those of all other enslaved nations of Europe. And now, in accordance with its old tradition, our nation links its destiny with that of the peace-loving world. At the moment when in Prague, the shots of retribution have sounded forth for all those murdered and enslaved, the Czechoslovak government in name of its nation sends to all those fighting and suffering patriots in Belgium, France, Holland, Yugoslavia, Luxembourg, Norway, Poland, and Greece a message of solidarity, admiration, and a firm faith that besides the great four allies, the British Empire, the USSR, the United States, and China, our lands will share the glory of victory. The government is aware that the miserable failure of Heydrich's effort will now inflame Hitler's henchmen to commit new murders. New Czech victims are already falling in the German execution yards, but this new fury of the Nazis will again be miserably broken by the unyielding resistance of the Czech people and will only strengthen its perseverance. Once again, my name is Desmond, and I thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it has been informational. In case I don't see you, good morning. Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.